Ainsley. She feels like a traitor and a heel, but on Sunday morning, when Aunt Harper goes to the hospital to give Megan her baby present, after only 2 hours in labor, she delivered David Wayne Mitzak. Ainsley claims a migraine.
I need to sleep,
Ainsley says. Harper gives her a skeptical look.
Please, Ainsley says, it's 8 o'clock on a Sunday.
You've known Megan a lot longer than I have, Harper says.
She's a bitch,
Ainsley says.
Kidding. Give her my love.
But who names a baby Wayne anyway? It's like a name from one of those silent westerns. Harper shakes her head. You're not getting out of going to the beach, she says. Ramsey is coming at noon.
Fine,
Ainsley says. I'll be ready.
I just have to sleep now.
I'm leaving Fish here to keep an eye on you, Harper says. Ainsley pulls the quilt up over her head. Ainsley waits until Harper is out of the driveway. Then she waits an extra 7 minutes on the off chance that Harper forgot something. Then Ainsley slips from bed, pulls on shorts, and shuffles into flip-flops. Fish is, in fact, standing right outside Ainsley's door, but Fish is a dog, not a person. He can't tell on her. Ainsley slips out the door. Fish barks. She hurries over to her grandmother's house. Philippa has gone to Boston to be with Grammy, so there is no one to avoid. Ainsley checks the bar cart first. She took the Gray Goose, and it hasn't been replaced. She considers walking with the Mount Gay or the Johnny Walker Black, but she can't chance Aunt Harper smelling it on her. And so, to the basement, Ainsley goes. The clocks chime 15 past the hour. Ainsley inhales the fragrance of her grandmother's Evening in Paris, which is also the perfume her mother wears. It's the scent of her oppressors. The basement of Seamless is like the basement of a morgue, only instead of dead bodies, the space is populated by headless dressmaker dummies, which terrify Ainsley and have done so since she was small. Tabitha keeps one as a conversation piece in their living room, despite Ainsley's protests. Ainsley must have had a nightmare at some point about the dummies coming to life or calling out in agony about their missing heads and limbs, because she can't explain her fear away. She knows they are horsehair and styrofoam, but they remind her of deformed bodies. Ainsley holds her breath the way she and her friends used to when they drove past one of Nantucket's many cemeteries, and she darts among the dummies to the far wall of the basement, against which Eleanor keeps stacked cases of booze. A bottle of Grey Goose. Just one bottle, although Ainsley considers taking two. She scurries back toward the stairs while the dummies stand in silent judgment. Ainsley catches sight of Kaylee's tangerine-colored Jeep through the filmy white curtains of Eleanor's front window. Next, she sees Kaylee herself wearing the Roxy in emerald green. The Roxy is a matronly dress, but somehow Kaylee totally rocks it. She's wearing nude patent leather heels, which make her legs look a mile long. Her hair is straight and shiny, and she's wearing cat's eye sunglasses.
Hey!
Ainsley says to Kaylee as she steps outside. Kaylee waves and trots through the gravel toward Ainsley in her heels.
Hey, girl!
She sees the bottle of Grey Goose, and her expression darkens.
What are you doing, Ainsley?
Ainsley holds up the bottle.
Shots, she says. Kidding. I was going to make a screwdriver. Do you want one? Are you on your way to brunch?
Ainsley knows Kaylee has hundreds of friends, all of them fun, and when she's not working, her life is a whirlwind of drinks, dinners, concerts, beach parties, and brunches. Ainsley can't wait to be older.
I just came from church, Kaylee says.
She produces a bouquet of hydrangeas from behind her back.
A woman on Main Street was selling these, and I thought of you.
She drops the bouquet in what looks like defeat.
I know it sucked for you to have your former friends come into the store like that, but Ainsley, you shouldn't be drinking. You're only 16.
Ainsley's mouth falls open. She can't believe Kaylee isn't being chill about this.
I'm serious, Ainsley, Kaylee says. Put that bottle back where you found it.
It's mine,
Ainsley says. It's not yours, Kaylee says. You just came out of your grandmother's house. Obviously you stole it.
I didn't steal anything, Ainsley says. This is where I live.
She swallows. It feels like there's a walnut caught in her throat.
You should probably go.
Leave.
Get off my property.
I'll happily go, Kaylee says, but I'm calling Harper to tell her.
Tell her what? Ainsley says.
She raises the bottle in defiance. Honestly, she is so angry, so indignant, that she would like to smash it on the ground.
This is mine!
Ainsley!
I thought you were my friend, Ainsley says.
Tears pool in her eyes, although the last thing she wants to do is cry in front of Kaylee. Suddenly, Kaylee's arms are around her.
Hey,
she says, I am your friend, which is why I'm going to insist you put the vodka back. I'll go with you. Ainsley takes a deep breath. She wants to inform Kaylee that she can't insist Ainsley do anything. Kaylee isn't her boss. Kaylee isn't her mother, her aunt, or her sister. Kaylee shouldn't even be working at the boutique. All Ainsley has to do is call her mother, and Kaylee will be fired. But when Ainsley opens her mouth, she starts to sob. She is so upset and so, so heartbroken. Teddy breaking up with her was one thing, but then she got suspended from school. How is that going to look on her transcript? And her friends betrayed her. Emma and Candace egged her house. But even so, when the two of them walked into the ERF boutique, Ainsley was pathetic enough to let her hopes rise. There was no doubt the party they had thrown at the boutique was cool. That it might have been cool enough to lure her friends back in wasn't something Ainsley had considered until she saw them stroll through the door. But they had only come to shoot Ainsley between the eyes with a poisoned dart about Teddy and Candace. Teddy was taking Candace to Ventuno for dinner, a place he had promised to take Ainsley because his Uncle Graham's girlfriend, Marcella, waited tables there and would let them order wine. Or maybe that was just Teddy talking big. It probably was. But even if there was no wine, there would still be candlelight and beautiful Italian food and Teddy across the table, holding Candace's hand and admiring the flower in her hair. And on top of all that, Ainsley's mother left, her grandmother left, and her father won't return her calls. Whom is she left with? Aunt Harper and Ramsey, both of whom feel sorry for her, she's certain. She lets Kaylee lead her back up the stairs of her grandmother's house. Kaylee waits in the doorway while Ainsley places the gray goose on the bar cart. Kaylee pulls a tissue out of her clutch and hands it to Ainsley, who wipes her eyes.
Can you come to Ram Pasture with us later?
Ainsley asks.
I'm going to Nobadir with my other friends today, Kaylee says. Besides, I don't think Ramsey would want me on your beach excursion.
Why not? Ainsley says.
I thought you guys were still friends.
We are, Kaylee says. But I think he's interested in your aunt.
My aunt? Ainsley says.
That's the sense I get, Kaylee says.
Oh,
Ainsley says. She's not sure what to think about that. She misses Ramsey terribly and would like him back in her life, but it wouldn't be fair if Ramsey started dating Harper. Poor Tabitha.
Well, thank you for these.
She sniffs the flowers.
And thanks for stopping by.
How about we grab breakfast one morning next week? Kaylee says. I know a great little place. It's kind of a secret.
Okay,
Ainsley says. She's embarrassed by how much the invitation thrills her. But then she worries that Kaylee sees her as a charity case, an ostracized teenager without any friends. She could turn Kaylee down. She doesn't eat breakfast. But her loneliness gets the best of her.
How about Wednesday?
Harper. They decide to take Harper's Bronco to Ram Pasture.
It's the quintessential beach buggy, Ramsey says. I will finally be one of the cool kids.
I wouldn't go that far, Ainsley says.
When they load up the Bronco, Harper feels like she's part of a family. Ramsey is the father figure, Harper the mother, Ainsley the child, Fish the dog. It's a peculiar sensation.
Harper is no one's mother, Ramsay is no one's father, and Ainsley is no longer really a child. Fish is, at least, a dog. Maybe because the construct is artificial, it feels fun, like play acting. Ramsay loads up 3 chairs, 6 towels, the Sunday New York Times, a brand new Carl Hiaasen novel, and a frisbee. Just seeing the frisbee causes Fish to bark. Harper is in charge of food and drink. She has made grilled chicken BLTs, a classic picnic macaroni salad she threw together, sliced sugared peaches, and lime sugar cookies. She fills a cooler with lots of cold bottled water. "And this," Ramsay says, handing her a bottle wrapped in a paper bag. It's a bottle of Rock Angel Rosé. Harper rolls her eyes. "You too? I thought all chic women like to drink rosé at the beach. Your sister loves it." "I'm not my sister," Harper says. "Normally I drink beer, but my stomach has been funny lately." The truth was, she had nearly vomited up her breakfast that morning. She constantly feels dizzy and unsettled, like she's just stepped off a carnival ride. "Let's just take it," Ramsay says. "Please." Harper unsheathes the bottle and plunges it into the icy bath of the cooler. She won't make a big deal about it. Today will be pleasant. Today they will be like a family from a storybook, one without conflicts, one without vices, one without history. They drive the Bronco out Matticat Road, and Ramsay shows Harper where to turn left. They turn onto the dirt and sand of Barrett Farm Road. It takes them on a winding, slightly bumpy journey over an open plain that reminds Harper of pictures she's seen of the African savanna. This is nothing like the vineyard. The vineyard has hills and trees, both pine forest and lush deciduous stands. Nantucket, by comparison, is flat, with low-lying vegetation that makes it easy to see the blue ribbon of the ocean in the distance. There's a pond on the left, and bushes of Rosa rugosa with their lovely pink blossoms. She sees a red-tailed hawk circling overhead. Has that hawk ever made the trip 11 miles west to the vineyard? She wonders. She misses Reed. The pain is constant, a heartache, a gut ache. He has moved out and stopped working at the hospital. Nobody knows where he is. Is he thinking about Harper? Is he thinking about anything other than Harper? Does Sadie know where he is? Does she call him? Do they talk? Is his leave from the hospital permanent? Has he been fired? If he has been fired, will he work elsewhere? And if so, where will he go? Is he eating, drinking, smoking, reading, riding his bike? Did Harper ruin his life? Does he blame her? That's what she really wants to know. Their relationship, the affair, was a mutual decision, as much his as hers. But Reed may feel he has paid more dearly than she has for their indiscretion. Harper would like to tell him that she, too, has paid dearly. She lost her job. She shredded what was left of her reputation. But what hurts the most is that she lost him. She wonders if the relationship would have fallen apart on its own with Billy's death. The circumstances that knit them together would have changed. What would they have had in common? "You're awfully quiet," Ramsay says, snapping Harper out of her reverie. She offers him a smile. "Sorry," she says. "Just thinking." "About?" he asks. Harper checks the rear view. Ainsley has her face buried in Fish's neck, and she's humming along to the radio. "The usual," she says. The beach is stunning. A wide swath of sand that extends in both directions with only a few people visible in the distance. The waves pound the sand, and Fish runs to the water's edge and barks his happiness, his relief. He has missed the ocean. Ramsay puts up a striped umbrella and sets up the chairs, arranging Harper's out in the sun with 2 neatly folded towels and a cold bottle of water tucked in the cup holder of the armrest. Ainsley arranges her towel in the sand, then charges in the water, shrieking with delight. Harper follows suit, diving into an oncoming wave. This is her first swim of the season, and the water is divine. She developed her preference for cold water during all those summers that she and Tabitha spent at Winegonnet Camp, swimming in Moose Pond. Harper treads water while looking at the horizon. The day is so crystalline that she can just make out the vineyard in the distance. Chappie. What she's seeing is the coastline of Chappaquiddick. Brendan, Drew, and Reed. They're all over there. She turns back toward shore. Ainsley climbs out of the water, splashing Ramsey as she goes. Ramsey has taken off his glasses. He looks younger, and Harper can easily imagine him in a Boy Scout uniform decorated with the most demanding badges: first aid, citizenship, life-saving. He squints and waves in her general direction. As the day goes by, Harper feels better, more centered, less lost. She and Ramsey settle on the blanket under the umbrella to eat lunch. Ainsley has fallen asleep face down on her towel, and Harper, in her mother role, covers her back and shoulders with her sarong so she doesn't burn. The picnic is delicious, if Harper does say so herself. Ramsey says, "I can't believe what a great cook you are." Harper laughs. "It's a sandwich." "Well, your sister has a hard time with cold cereal," he says. "She is my mother reincarnated," Harper says. "I realized when you said you were thinking about the usual that I know almost nothing about you," Ramsey says. "Have you ever been married?" "Never married, no kids," Harper says. "That's unusual, right?" Ramsey says. "You and Tabitha are almost 40 and neither of you ever married?" "Let's assume it was our parents' fault," Harper says. "Do you have someone special on the vineyard?" Ramsey asks. Harper shrugs. "It's too complicated to explain. It was the right time to get away. I actually can't believe Tabitha allowed me to stay. So she must have needed a break herself." "She did," Ramsey says. "Explain to me how she can be so uptight and you can be so laid back. Was it always that way?" Was it always that way? Tabitha had long been an approval seeker, whereas Harper figured if other people didn't like her, they could buzz off. Harper was, by nature, lazy and easily distracted. She had barely made it through Tulane. Bourbon Street was simply too alluring. As an adult, it seems, the traits that distinguished the twins from each other had only become exaggerated and solidified. Although what, really, did Harper know of Tabitha's life over the past 14 years? Harper hasn't spent any time with her sister since the week leading up to Julian's death. Those fraught, frantic days had been the time when Harper had felt closest to her sister. Isn't that true? The fault lines created when Billy and Eleanor divorced had knit themselves back together and nearly healed. Until the final night. After that final night, the relationship ended. "She lost a child," Harper says. "That changes a person." "She lets that loss overshadow everything in her life that's good. She does it still. She doesn't open herself up to the possibility of future happiness, real happiness."
"With you, you mean?"
"I wanted to have a baby with her," Ramsey says. "No sooner did I say the words than Tabitha asked me to move out."
Harper nods. She suddenly feels protective of her sister. She understands why Ramsey would want a child, but she also realizes that Tabitha would never have conceded. No way. The topic is too complex and painful to discuss any further, and Harper isn't going to let the day go up in flames. "You know my sister far better than I do. I haven't known her in a long time. You never told me what happened between the two of you," Ramsey says. "When I asked you about it at the brewery, you changed the subject."
"For good reason," Harper says. She gets to her feet. "How about a glass of that rosé?" The afternoon sun beats down as Harper sips at her glass of wine, and Ramsey does the Times crossword puzzle in his chair. Harper is lying across the blanket reading Valley of the Dolls, a book she found on Tabitha's shelves that has Eleanor's name written in pencil inside the front cover. Harper has never read it, but she knows it was splashy and scandalous in its day,
and part of the joy of reading it is imagining Eleanor's shock, and possibly her delight, at the sex and the pills. So many pills. Ramsey looks up from his puzzle.
Myanmar to JFK. 5 letters.
Burma, Harper says without looking up.
Look at you, Ramsey says.
You'd never know it, but I had a very expensive education, Harper says. Windsor, then Tulane.
Tulane?
Ramsey says. Impressive. Not so impressive, Harper says. I barely graduated. I pretty much majored in shots at Pat O'Brien's.
You've never told me what you do for a living, Ramsey says.
Until recently, I delivered packages for a Mickey Mouse operation called Rooster Express, she says. Before that, I did it all. Ice cream scooper, cocktail waitress, landscaper, drug mule. Ramsey laughs, and Harper goes back to her book. When Ramsey fills his glass with the last of the rosé, he settles down on the towel next to Harper. Harper immediately checks on Ainsley. She's still snoring away on her towel. Harper has forgotten how long and deeply teenagers can sleep. Fish is dozing in the shade behind Ramsey's chair.
I've had enough, son, Ramsey says.
He is too close to Harper. She sits up. I could actually use some sun, I think.
You don't have to get up, Ramsey says.
He reaches out for her blindly. His glasses are off, and he ends up grabbing her thigh. It takes her by surprise, and she responds by swatting at him. It's meant to be a get-your-hands-off-me swat, but it ends up being more playful than stern. The little bit of wine she's had has gone to her head, and the next thing she knows, she and Ramsey are tussling on the blanket. She tries to wrestle away, but finds herself with her hands pinned over her head, Ramsey's face hovering above hers. Ramsey, she says, don't. She gets purposefully to her feet. Fish barks. Ramsey holds his hands up.
Whoa, he says. Talk about mixed signals.
Has she been sending mixed signals? If she has, it has been unintentional. She should never have agreed to come to the beach with Ramsey. Harper stares at him, at a loss for words. Ramsey is a lovely and authentic person. She loves the buttoned-up order of him, the preppy clothes, the horn-rimmed glasses, his soothing manner, and his earnest desire to help. He is Clark Kent and Superman. Or he has been until now. Now he's just a man on the move. There is no way Harper is going to let anyone else get close to her, least of all Tabitha's ex-boyfriend. You said earlier that you don't know anything about me. And you don't, really. I realize that I look just like Tabitha, and it must be disconcerting to discover that we're so different. Opposite, even. She maintains eye contact with Ramsey, though it's hard. His face is about to crumple with dejection. She looks at Ainsley's chest rising and falling with breaths of ocean air. Then she watches the encroaching and retreating of the waves. This is not her island. This is some place she is visiting, borrowing even. I need you to believe me when I say that the last thing I need is another boyfriend. Ramsey, to his credit, asks the right question. What do you need? Harper gives him a small, sad smile. A friend, she says. Fish barks. A human friend. I'm in, Ramsey says. Ainsley. She meets Kaylee at the corner of Broad and Water Streets at 8:30 in the morning on Wednesday for breakfast. Kaylee greets her with an enthusiastic hug and a kiss on the cheek, as though she is a sorority sister or a soulmate, and Ainsley stands up a little straighter. She worked with Kaylee on Monday, and although Kaylee had been civil, even pleasant with Ainsley, there had been a distant reserve, or so Ainsley thought. No chatter, no confidences shared. Ainsley worried that Kaylee no longer found her worthy of her friendship or tutelage. Ainsley had let her down. How had she so severely misread Kaylee? Kaylee was a good person in a cool body, whereas Emma Marlowe was a bad person in a cool body. Kaylee had just come from church and wanted to stop by with flowers for Ainsley as a gesture of solidarity. She had been wearing the Roxy because it was appropriate for church and it was promoting the brand she worked for. Ainsley shudders when she thinks of how disappointed Kaylee must have been to see Ainsley holding the vodka, which she had, indeed, stolen from Eleanor's house. And then she had told Kaylee to get off her property, which is something you say when you're 5 years old. Ainsley realizes she needs to clean up her act, or she's going to lose everyone close to her. Tuesday was Kaylee's day off, and Ainsley worked with Aunt Harper. But on Tuesday night, Ainsley sent Kaylee a text that said, "Are we still on for breakfast tomorrow?" Kaylee had responded immediately, "You bet." Being downtown, and yes, Ainsley knows that four square blocks of Nantucket hardly qualify as a downtown, but it's what she has grown up with, used to be fun. Now it's a place filled with pitfalls. Ainsley could bump into anyone from school at any moment, which is why she has kept her trajectory simple. Home, work, home. She hasn't been into Force 5 to try on bikinis. She hasn't shopped for earrings at Jessica Hicks. She hasn't gone to the juice bar for ice cream. But when Kaylee threads her arm through Ainsley's, it's like protection. Ainsley lets Kaylee lead her across Broad Street and up the stairs of a Victorian house. "Ainsley?" Ainsley swivels her head around. Teddy is standing on the porch of the house, wearing a uniform of khaki pants and a white polo emblazoned with the name of the property, 21 Broad. "What are you doing here?" Wait, Ainsley is discombobulated. Kaylee said they were going to some secret place for breakfast, and now they're standing on the front porch of the hotel where Teddy works. It's going to look like she's stalking him. Ainsley takes half a step back, but Kaylee holds her fast. "We've come for breakfast," Kaylee says. "I've been invited by the owner." Teddy looks back and forth between Ainsley and Kaylee, clearly confused but maybe also impressed. "Right this way," Teddy says. In back of the hotel is a charming porch, and set up on long wooden tables is what's called the small plates breakfast. Ainsley hadn't been excited about actually eating, but she's never been anywhere that has a breakfast as enticing as this. There are locally roasted coffees and organic teas, glass pitchers of juice in jewel tones, and a platter of fresh fruit, fat berries and figs, and fresh sliced peaches and plums, wedges of watermelon and rings of juicy pineapple. There are two kinds of smoothie, kale and strawberry, and there are freshly made scones with clotted cream and guava jam. There is overnight oatmeal with raisins, nuts, and dried cherries, and there is an elaborate platter of cheeses and meats and smoked fish. Kaylee picks a table in the corner, then she leads Ainsley over to the buffet, and together they start filling their plates. "This is actually the prettiest breakfast I've ever seen," Ainsley says. "How did you find out about this place?" "The owner used to come into the Straight Wharf," Kaylee says. "He told me about it and invited me to come try it." "You are so lucky," Ainsley says. "There were a lot of perks in that job," Kaylee says. "I miss it." Ainsley feels a pang of fear. "But you like the boutique, right?" "Right," Kaylee says. Ainsley exhales. The worst thing that could happen now is for Kaylee to quit the shop and go back to bartending. "I'm so angry about how I lost my job," Kaylee says. "I have a revenge dream about the man who grabbed me. In the dream, I stick a corkscrew in his eye." "Nice," Ainsley says. "Would you like coffee?" Kaylee asks. "I'd better not," Ainsley says. Her heart feels like a rock that is skipping across the surface of the water. Teddy, Teddy, Teddy. Ainsley thinks about him all the time, but seeing him has jarred her. She had hoped that she had built him up only in her mind and that in person he would seem diminished. The bad news is he's even more appealing in person, and now her longing for him is sharper, which she didn't even think was possible. "That was a friend of yours out there?" Kaylee asks, spearing half a strawberry. "My old boyfriend. He dates Candace now, the redhead who came into the shop during the party." How long did you go out with him?
Kaylee asks.
All of last year, Ainsley says. He was new. I made friends with him on the first day of school, and by the end of the week, he was my boyfriend.
It seems like a lifetime ago, but Ainsley can remember how jumped up they had all been by a new boy in their grade. Ainsley, Emma, Maggie, probably even Candace, all of them had been excited, and who can blame them? They had all been swimming circles in the cloudy fishbowl that is the Nantucket Public School since kindergarten. Over the years, they had seen kids come and go, but mostly go. Danny Dalrymple and Charlotte Budd went to boarding school, and Saber Podwatt's parents moved to Swampscott because they couldn't afford to live on Nantucket anymore. Emma had seen Teddy first because they had both driven to school and been assigned spots near each other in the parking lot.
Prepare to be disappointed, Emma had texted. He looks like a refugee from the dipshit rodeo. Hashtag everything but the Spurs.
As luck would have it, Teddy had been assigned to Ainsley's first block English class, and before Mr. Duncombe had given them their permanent seats, Teddy had chosen the chair next to Ainsley's. He had been wearing Wrangler jeans, a flannel shirt over a plain white undershirt, cowboy boots, and a cross on a leather strap around his neck.
Everything but the Spurs, Ainsley thought. Dipshit rodeo.
But Teddy wasn't ugly. Far from it. He had auburn hair, freckles across his nose, strong shoulders, long legs. The outfit was off-putting, but Ainsley knew better than anyone that new clothes were an easy fix. Put this kid in a Force 5 t-shirt and Madras shorts and a pair of Reefs, and he would be hot. He had his jaw set, his green eyes focused forward on the whiteboard, which was blank except for Mr. Duncombe's name and email address. Ainsley remembered the stories she had heard. Father dead, mother suicidal, then hospitalized, kid shipped 2/3 of the way across the country, then 30 miles out to sea. He probably felt like a longhorn steer dropped into a tank of killer whales. Ainsley tapped the edge of his desk to get his attention.
Hi, she said. I'm Ainsley Cruz. Welcome to Nantucket High School.
He had given her a slow cowboy smile, filled with relief and gratitude. Thank you, he said. That first week, Ainsley had made welcoming Teddy Elkwatt her personal mission. She showed him where the wood shop was. She invited him to sit with her in the cafeteria. She introduced him to B.C. and Max Cunningham and Kalik and D-Ray and the other jocks and insisted they be nice to him. Emma was as skeptical and crude as ever, joking that Ainsley was working off her mandatory community service hours by being nice to Sheriff Woody Pride. Either that or she was hoping to finally lose her virginity, and wasn't it common knowledge that ranch hands were well hung? Ainsley ignored Emma's comments. To defend him would only fuel Emma's fire, and she found that she really liked Teddy. The first days of school were still warm, and Teddy had use of his uncle's truck, so Ainsley showed him a different beach each day. By Friday, out on Smith's Point, with the coastline of Tuckernut close enough for Teddy to throw a baseball at, Ainsley persuaded him to take off his boots and his Wrangler jeans and go for a swim. He had hooted with fear in the cold, although in early September, the water was as warm as it got all year, and admitted it was his first time in the ocean. They sat on a beach towel together afterward, Teddy basking in the late afternoon sun, and he started telling Ainsley things. His father was a hero, a first responder to a huge industrial fire. He had died instantly in a chemical blast. His mother hadn't been particularly stable before the accident, but afterward she lost her mind. She locked herself in her bedroom for days, Teddy said. She didn't cook, didn't shop, didn't shower. I finally called 911 myself. Once my mother had been committed, my father's younger brother reached out. Uncle Graham. He saved me from foster care. Uncle Graham was cool, but Teddy wasn't sure about Nantucket. It's cold-hearted here, Teddy said. Yankee. At home in Oklahoma, he said, there was plentiful sunshine, football, open space,
Long highways, 1,000-acre farms, 10,000-acre ranches, barbecue and good music.
What do you consider good music? Ainsley asked.
He had played her a song called Head Over Boots by John Party. And as the song was ending and the sun setting, he'd kissed her. They became boyfriend and girlfriend. Ainsley bought him a couple of sweaters from J. Crew and some long-sleeve t-shirts, a pair of new jeans. He traded in his boots for Nikes. Emma allowed him to sit at their lunch table, but she did not fully embrace him. She called him Woody to his face and imitated his accent. Ainsley knew that Emma was jealous, but she couldn't figure out if Emma wanted Teddy for her own or if she didn't like losing Ainsley's time and attention. Ainsley told Teddy things she had never been comfortable sharing with anyone else, about her parents, their split, her father moving off-island and starting a new family, effectively leaving Ainsley to be ruled by a two-woman dictatorship. Ainsley even told Teddy about her brother, Julian, who had been born premature and had, one night, simply stopped breathing, leaving Tabitha an emotional cripple. Ainsley and Teddy didn't have sex until Thanksgiving. Ainsley had enjoyed dinner with her mother and grandmother at Ramsey's house with Ramsey's family. Tabitha had been in one of her rare happy drunk moods, taking Ainsley's face into her hands and calling her Honey Bear and Honey Pear. She had been slurring her words, and Ainsley was anxious to get to the driveway, where Teddy idled in Uncle Graham's truck. Teddy and Uncle Graham had gone to the fairgrounds for their Thanksgiving dinner. Full plate turkey and all the trimmings for $19.95, with seconds and thirds included. But now Graham was drinking with his scalloping buddies at the bar, and Teddy had the truck and no curfew. They had gone to the carriage house and done it in Ainsley's bed. It had hurt a little, but the hurt paled to how wonderful it felt to be that close to Teddy. All these memories zip through Ainsley's mind as she stares at her fruit salad. She looks up at Kaylee, who is mixing dried cherries into her overnight oatmeal with the intensity of a chemist seeking the Nobel Prize. Kaylee, she has noticed, isn't afraid of food. She relishes eating, yet she remains slender. Such a thing is also possible, like being cool and going to church.
I have to go to the bathroom, Ainsley says.
I can't believe you're leaving your scone unprotected, Kaylee says. She grins.
Kidding. Go.
Ainsley wanders out to the lobby of the inn, looking for Teddy. There is a stunning young woman with thick dark hair and olive skin and a beauty mark working at the front desk, and Ainsley feels a stab of jealousy. Maybe Teddy has left Candace. Maybe he's dating this young woman now, or maybe he's having an affair with one of the older, attractive divorcees staying at the hotel alone. For someone like Teddy, Ainsley supposes, the possibilities are endless. Beauty Mark looks up from her computer terminal.
Can I help you? She asks.
At the same time, Ainsley hears her name. Teddy is galloping down the stairs toward her. Beneath the white polo shirt of his uniform, Ainsley sees the leather strap and, dangling from it, the cross. She knows now that Teddy has been raised Pentecostal. She had always meant to Google what that meant, but she never has. Candace probably knows. Maybe it's similar to being Catholic.
Hey, Ainsley says.
Hey, Teddy says. He is tan under his freckles, and his hair is a shade lighter, golden glints in the red. He's been in the sun, at the beach, probably with Candace and Emma and BC and Anna and all Ainsley's former friends. The tan makes him look healthy and strong. It's a blessing summer has bestowed upon him. At least Ainsley got to the beach on Sunday with Harper and Ramsey. Maybe she looks like she's glowing too, although she kind of doubts it. Most of her summer so far has been spent under the fluorescent lights of the boutique or in her bedroom, doing her summer reading. She's going back to school in the fall as one of the truly pathetic kids who actually found time to get it finished before Labor Day weekend.
I was looking for the ladies' room, she says.
Who's that woman you're here with? Teddy asks. My friend, Ainsley says. Kaylee.
Never seen her before,
Teddy says.
Is she in college?
Out of college, Ainsley says. She used to bartend at the Straight Wharf. Your uncle probably knows her.
Probably, Teddy says. So, is she, like, your nanny or babysitter then?
No, Ainsley says with a patient smile. She's just a friend. How is your summer going?
He shrugs. Fine, I guess.
How's Candace? Ainsley asks. She doesn't mean to ask this. She doesn't want to know. Yes, she does, but she doesn't want him to know that she wants to know. I heard you took her for dinner at Ventuno.
Teddy's forehead creases the way it used to when he didn't understand the math homework.
I didn't take Candace to Ventuno, he says. Emma did.
What?
Ainsley says. I don't have the money to take Candace to Ventuno.
But you have a job.
I sign my checks over to Graham. He's saving them for my college tuition. But Dutch gives Emma however much money she wants. She took Candace to Ventuno, and they both got really drunk, I guess. Then Candace threw up in the street outside the juice bar, and I guess Mr. Duncombe was in line with his kids, and he called Candace's parents to come pick her up.
Oh, Ainsley says. She is vibrating with suppressed glee. Emma, not Teddy, took Candace. The announcement in the boutique was a bluff. The detail about the flower in Candace's hair had been fabricated, and Candace, an altar girl at St. Mary's, had gotten sick in front of the juice bar, and Mr. Duncombe saw her. The only downside to this story is that Ainsley hasn't heard it from anyone else. She is really and truly a social pariah if no one thought to share this news with her. Ainsley warns herself against being too judgmental. If she had stayed on her self-destructive course, she could easily have been the girl puking on the street. But it wasn't her this time.
You and Candace are still a couple, though, right?
Ainsley says. Teddy scuffs the toe of his plastic-looking topsider against the wooden floor.
Honestly, I'm not sure. She hangs out with Emma all the time now. They go to the beach together every day. Neither of them has to work. They go to parties with all the summer kids.
That's what I did last summer with Emma, Ainsley says.
Yeah, Teddy says. It's like Candace is you now. The new you.
If Candace is the new me, then who am I?
Teddy gives her the slow cowboy smile. Ainsley basks in the warmth of his gaze. He's looking at her the way he used to, and she nearly falls into that golden pond. But no, she will not be such a pushover.
Ladies' room?
She asks. Teddy snaps back to his senses. Behind you, he says.
Thanks, Ainsley says. See you around.
When Ainsley returns to the table, Kaylee says,
I was about to send a search party.
Ainsley spears a juicy chunk of pineapple. She thinks she handled Teddy pretty well, considering. She didn't tear up or beg him to take her back. She wasn't snotty or disdainful or sarcastic, even when he asked her the offensive question about Kaylee being her babysitter. She had been pleasant, calm, even-tempered. If Candace is the new Ainsley, then maybe Ainsley is now the old Ainsley, the person she had been before meeting Emma. Ainsley's phone pings.
Wonder who that could be,
Kaylee says. But she sounds like she already knows. Ainsley checks the display. It's Teddy. I miss you, the text says. Can I call you sometime? Tabitha. Finding a contractor to work on Billy's house is going to be more challenging than Tabitha imagined. It's not like choosing a dry cleaner or a pizza delivery place. Billy's house doesn't have Wi-Fi. The house is resolutely stuck in 1993, so Tabitha resorts to using the good old Martha's Vineyard phone book, which she finds on the mantle next to the urn containing Billy's ashes. She turns to the back, the business listings, and looks under general contractors. There are dozens and dozens of them, and for a moment she is heartened.
She doesn't know any of these builders from Adam, so she decides she'll start with AA Vineyard Builders and proceed alphabetically from there. Number 1. Waiting list of 3 years. 2. Sorry, we're booked solid for the foreseeable future. 3. Is the project inside? I may be able to sub out my New Bedford team in January. 4. What's the last name again? Frost, Tabitha says. Click. 5. No answer. 6. Voicemail. Tabitha leaves a message. 7. I'm sorry, we can't take on any new projects at the moment. 8. Frost? As in Harper Frost? That chick who ratted out Joey Bowen? Click. 9. I'll have my husband or his partner call you back by the end of the month at the very latest. 10. Sorry. 11. Sorry. 12. I wish I could say yes, I really do, but I'm just the mother-in-law. My daughter and son-in-law are in Vermont until Labor Day. A lot of builders take the summer off. You might want to call back in September. 13. This number has been disconnected. 14. I'm free, but is the house down island? I refuse to work on any house that's down island. I'm simply not dealing with that traffic every day. 15. I'm slammed, quite frankly, but I know for a fact that Franklin Phelps is finishing up a house in Katama and is looking for something small right now. He might be able to help you. You got his number? Tabitha freezes. Franklin Phelps, you say? You got his number? No, I'm using the phone book. She runs her fingers down the listings to pee. She doesn't see the phone book. Lady, I can promise you, you will never find a builder using the phone book. You need to know someone. Call Franklin Phelps. Tell him TF sent you. Here's his number. Tabitha writes down the number, then hangs up the phone and stares at the notepad. Franklin is a builder in addition to being a musician. Okay. Franklin could be the answer to her prayers if she hadn't slept with him. But because she slept with him, because she has honestly not been able to stop thinking about him, she cannot possibly call him. She decides to abandon the cold calling for the time being and do something productive. She's off to the dump. She loads up the disgusting rag rugs, the old bath mats, and the mildewed shower curtains. She gets rid of the hideous lamps, stacks of magazines, chipped dishes, Tupperware without tops, the Jaws poster that hangs in the powder room, the broken microwave, the dollar store oil paintings, the plastic placemats and rickety TV trays, the cracked canisters for sugar and flour, both empty. She tosses old batteries and half-empty cans of paint, boxes and boxes of defunct light bulbs, frayed extension cords, a dented colander, and baking pans that contain the residue of 100 nights of burned nachos. It's all going. It's Sunday, and the dump is crowded. It must be mostly locals, because Tabitha immediately picks up a sense of community. People exude harried good cheer. It's summer, they're busy, there is money to be made, and if they do happen to have the weekend off, they want to get to the beach. But no one is too busy to lend a hand. An old gentleman with white hair and a long white beard, looking like a skinny Santa, sees Tabitha discarding the Jaws poster and offers to give her $10 for it. Oh, please, Tabitha says, just take it. Unloading all the crap out of the back of the car feels good, the same way that flossing her teeth feels good. As Tabitha is getting ready to leave, she notices a woman wearing a mannish crew cut and a pair of really ugly boots step out of a truck that says Garden Goddesses on the side. Local landscaper, Tabitha thinks. She remembers what TF told her on the phone. You have to know someone. Okay, Tabitha thinks. Here goes. Excuse me, she says. I'm looking for a general contractor to do a gut renovation on my father's house down island. She squints at the sky. She can't remember. Is Billy's house down island? She thinks down island is Oak Bluffs and Vineyard Haven, but actually that makes no sense because Chilmark and Aquinnah are south, so maybe that's down island? It's in Tisbury, the house. The woman stares at Tabitha with undisguised contempt, and Tabitha gets it. She hates nothing more on Nantucket than being asked questions by tourists, or even worse, brand new residents. Tabitha always counted her impatience as a personality flaw, but now she sees it's a trait that people on the vineyard share. There's a certain way things are done here, and if you don't know what it is, then you don't belong. A general contractor? The woman says. You've got to be kidding me. You'll never find anyone to work for you on this island.
I know, right? Tabitha says. I called 15 people this morning, and not one of them could do it. I had no idea it would be so difficult. I thought maybe if you had any suggestions.
But the woman gets into her truck, slams the door, and through the open window gives Tabitha the finger. Tabitha thinks, wow, okay. Vineyarders aren't only impatient, they're also mean and vulgar. It's only after the truck drives off in a cloud of dust that it dawns on Tabitha that the woman must have thought Tabitha was Harper. She must have been one more person whom Harper pissed off. You'll never find anyone to work for you on this island.
I'm not Harper,
Tabitha wants to shout. She's about to cry and thinks that Harper was probably right. They should tear down the house because they will never find anyone available and willing to fix it up. But it has such potential. She recognized that as she was clearing it out. There are wide plank heart pine floors under the crappy carpeting. It was such a find that Tabitha hooted with delight. But the process of pulling up the carpet and the pad and bringing those floors to life is a job that's beyond her modest DIY skills. She feels a hand on her shoulder and turns to see the skinny Santa who took the Jaws poster.
I happened to overhear your conversation, he says. My wife and I used a company called Hammer and Claw for a guest house we built for our kids and grandkids to use. The principal guy's name is Phelps, Franklin Phelps.
Tabitha nods, knowing she should be surprised, but she doesn't feel at all surprised. Franklin's company is called Hammer and Claw, and this is now the second time this morning he has been recommended. Tabitha still feels stung by the charming woman from Garden Goddesses, and Tabitha would like to point out that this woman is no one's idea of a goddess, but she gives Skinny Santa a smile for the kindness of his input, as unsettling as it is.
Thank you, she says.
Back at home, Tabitha checks the phone book. She had made it through the alphabet to Haggerty Construction, and the very next listing is Hammer and Claw. Is it a sign? Third time's a charm? Or, now that she has been warned this is Franklin's company, should she skip down to Inkwell Beach Builders? She's dying to talk to Franklin, which is an argument only for not calling. If she calls, it could easily end badly for her. Her mother would, no doubt, advise Tabitha not to call. A woman should never pursue a man, in her opinion, although it's a well-documented fact that Eleanor ruthlessly stole Billy Frost from her cousin Rhonda. And what would Billy say? Tabitha wonders. She eyes the urn containing his ashes. Safe to assume Billy would give advice opposite to Eleanor's.
Nothing's going to happen until you make it happen.
She's in Billy's house. Perhaps that's why his argument is more compelling. Franklin answers on the first ring.
Yo.
Yo? Tabitha thinks. That's the way Ainsley's friends answer the phone. It's probably not inappropriate, then, that she suddenly feels like a 16-year-old trying to pass for an adult.
Oh, hello, she says, wondering if her acting skills are up to snuff or if she will be completely transparent. I'm looking for a contractor for my father's house on Daggett Avenue. My father recently passed away, and I want to do a gut renovation so I can put the house on the market.
Uh-huh, Franklin says. How many square feet is the house? And when were you thinking of starting?
It's a little over 1,700 square feet, Tabitha says, and I'd like to start as soon as we can. Tomorrow, if possible.
Tomorrow, Franklin says. I can see you're a woman who knows what she wants. It just so happens I'm finishing a project in Katama, and I don't have anything else lined up until fall, so I may be able to squeeze this in if, and this is a big if, it's not too extensive. I'm going to have to come look at it before I give you an answer.
Oh, Tabitha says. Okay. The address is 5549 Daggett Avenue. When were you thinking of coming over?
I'm free right now, Franklin says.
Okay, Tabitha says.
I'm sorry, I didn't get your name, Franklin says.
She closes her eyes. Tabitha, she says. Tabitha Frost.
Silence. He's going to hang up, she thinks.
Then he says, Tabitha?
Yes,
she says. This is Franklin. Franklin Phelps, from the other night?
What? Tabitha says. You're kidding. I didn't realize. I'm sorry. The phone book just said hammer and claw.
Don't apologize, please, Franklin says. Listen, I'm coming over now, okay? Right this second. Don't go anywhere.
I won't, she says. I'll be right.
But Franklin has hung up. Tabitha runs to find a brush and lipstick. She doesn't know what to expect. She's sober, it's daytime, this is a business call. Will it be weird? Will the magic be gone? That's what she hopes for, of course. That the magic is gone. That Franklin Phelps is just another guy, less attractive and not at all appealing under this new set of circumstances. From the window, she watches him pull up in a big black Dodge pickup, then stride up the walk. He's wearing Carhartt pants and a black dog t-shirt that has a rip in the neck. He's the most gorgeous man she's ever seen. This is bad. Very bad. She wants to go crawl under one of the beds with the dust bunnies. When she opens the door, he stares at her. Then he shakes his head. I'm going to put my pride on the line here. This morning I looked at the ferry schedule to Nantucket.
You, what?
I wanted to go over and find you, Franklin says. I've been thinking of you, basically nonstop since Friday night.
Tabitha grabs him by the dog on the front of his shirt and pulls him inside. They make love in the kitchen and nearly pull the countertop free of the wall in the process. Franklin is behind Tabitha, kissing the back of her neck.
Yeah, he says. This house needs some work.
She shows him the pine floors under the carpet, the powder room, the three underwhelming bedrooms upstairs.
I'm not going to lie to you, Franklin says. This project is exactly the right size for me to take on. I can get this done in 6 weeks.
6 weeks? Tabitha says.
She can't believe her reversal of fortune. This morning she had neither Franklin nor a contractor, and now she has both.
But, Franklin says,
or not both, she thinks.
He runs his hands through his dark hair.
There are extenuating circumstances, he says.
What are they? Tabitha says.
Girlfriend, she thinks. Or he doesn't want to commit to Tabitha, because what if he doesn't like her as much as he thinks he does?
I don't want to get into it, he says. Just let me think about it, okay?
Okay, she says.
What are you doing right now? He asks.
Other than trying to find a contractor, you mean?
Put your swimsuit on, he says, and a pair of sneakers. We're going to the beach.
Franklin drives her to a place called Cedar Tree Neck, a nature preserve on a spit of land known as the Fish Hook in Vineyard Haven. They walk through a thickly wooded area that offers luxurious shade on a hot day. Through the canopy of trees, bits of brilliant blue sky are visible, and Tabitha hears birdsong. When was the last time Tabitha enjoyed nature? Probably when she was 15 years old at Camp Wineganak. They hike along in silence for a while, holding hands. Then they crest a hill and Franklin stops. He takes her face in his hands and kisses her. His face has a day's worth of growth on it, which is so sexy against her face that her knees nearly buckle. The kissing intensifies. Franklin backs her up against a tree.
Are we?
She whispers into his mouth.
Here?
He nods, reaching a hand into the bottom of her bathing suit. The trail ends at a sandy, boulder-studded beach that cradles a small bay. Franklin lays out two towels, then he shucks off his shorts and races into the water, buck naked. Tabitha shrieks. She looks both ways down the beach. Nobody is around. She hesitates for a moment, wondering if she can go through with it. Swimming naked in a public place isn't something Tabitha Frost does. Tabitha Frost is dignified, her behavior unimpeachable. Tabitha Frost is uptight, she thinks. She unties her bikini and goes racing into the water. The feeling is novel and delicious. The water is soft as it envelops her, all of her. She feels coddled, like a baby in embryonic fluid. And she enjoys the daring of it. For the moments when she is in the water, she is free. Franklin scoops her up. When he kisses her, he tastes like salt water. She is weightless in his arms. Back on her towel on the warm beach, she raises her face bravely to the sun. Her shoulder blades melt into the sand, and she falls asleep. When she wakes up, the sun is lower in the sky, dappling the surface of the water. Tabitha turns her head to see Franklin on his side, his head propped on his arm, staring at her. "You are so beautiful," he says. Her stomach swoops. This is happening. Franklin has chosen a place called the Outermost Inn for dinner. "It's in Aquinnah," he says. "You'll see all of Up Island on the way." Tabitha puts on an orange Alexander Wang sundress with skinny straps that crisscross her now tanned back. It's the sexiest thing she owns, and she congratulates herself for deciding to bring it. Franklin whistles. "Or we can just stay here and I'll eat you for dinner." As they drive out South Road through Chilmark, Franklin plays the dutiful tour guide and shows Tabitha Beetle Bung Corner. A beetle, he explains, is a mallet used to bang bungs, or stoppers, into barrels. Tabitha laughs. "Thank you for telling me that. It sounds like something that infests your attic." She loves all the low stone walls and the family farms. "And the cute street signs. Look at that one." She points to a small wooden sign that says, "Sheep Exing." "Good old sheep crossing," Franklin says. The tone of his voice is suddenly arch. "The first cottage after the turn is where my brother-in-law is hiding out."
"Your brother-in-law?" Tabitha says.
She tries to remember what Franklin has told her about his family. She isn't good with this kind of thing. The parents, she has lost their names. The father was the high school principal. The mother, she can't remember. Did Franklin mention a brother-in-law? The husband of his sister? His sister's name is Charlotte? Nope, that's Ramsey's sister. She waits for him to say more, but he merely shakes his head. "Never mind," he says. Any awkwardness vanishes as they approach the Outermost Inn. It's set way up over the cliffs of Aquinnah. Even from the parking lot, the views over the water are dramatic. Franklin is a perfect gentleman, ushering Tabitha inside, his hand resting lightly on the small of her back. Tabitha thinks briefly of Ramsey. His manners were impeccable, bordering on stuffy. But he never electrified Tabitha with his touch, as Franklin does. The hostess at the intimate restaurant is roughly Tabitha's age. She has curly blonde hair and wears a silk broomstick skirt that reaches to her ankles. "Franklin," she says, "baby doll." "Annalisa," Franklin says. He kisses her on the lips, Tabitha notices. Okay, she's jealous. She feels a tightening across her shoulders and tries to fight it. She loves the decor of the inn, the candlelight, the smell of garlic, herbs, roasting meat, butter, good wine. She has known Franklin for a few days. He has lived here for 40 years. Tabitha smiles at Annalisa, hoping she will not be mistaken for her sister. "Hello," she says. "I'm Tabitha Frost. I live on Nantucket." "Oh, yes, I know,"
Annalisa says. The folks at the Steamship Authority send out an alert when someone from the other island broaches our shores.
Franklin squeezes Tabitha's shoulder, and Tabitha manages a smile.
Annalisa sits Franklin and Tabitha at the best table in the house, out on the wide, gracious porch in the corner closest to the water. Franklin selects a bottle of Sancerre and a bottle of Malbec, and he pours Tabitha a glass of each. They touch glasses, and Franklin shakes his head.
I can't tell you how happy I am that you called me, he says, even if it was by accident.
If you wanted me to call you not by accident, you should have left your number in the note, Tabitha says. I figured you'd never wanted to see me again.
Franklin sips his wine and looks off at the horizon, where the sun is sinking into the water. A streak of glorious orange light illuminates his face.
I wasn't sure of the protocol, I guess.
You can't tell me you don't bring women home all the time, Tabitha says.
I don't, Franklin says.
He gives her an earnest look. Could he possibly be telling the truth? And then he changes the subject.
Tell me about you. I can't believe you're single. A gorgeous woman like you on an island with all those millionaires on their yachts?
Tabitha laughs. Oh, I'm single. I was in a relationship for 4 years, but we broke up in February.
Have you ever been married? Franklin asks.
No, Tabitha says. But my first serious boyfriend and I have a child together. A daughter, Ainsley. She's 16.
16? Franklin says. Is that even possible?
Possible, Tabitha says. I had her when I was 23. She was a surprise then. Now she's just a handful. A few weeks ago, she threw a party at the house while I was out, and I came home to find the kids playing beer pong on my dining room table.
Franklin throws his head back and laughs.
Oh, come on. You have to admit that's funny, he says.
Is it funny?
Tabitha lets herself smile.
It's a lot funnier now than it was at the time, that's for certain. We're enjoying a much-needed break from each other right now. Harper's over there watching her.
Ah, I see, Franklin says. You pulled the old switcheroo.
Tabitha wonders how Harper and Ainsley are doing. Maybe they've rolled all the ERF inventory outside for a sidewalk sale. Maybe they've hosted a dog show or are posting their political opinions on a Twitter account under Eleanor's name. Tabitha is so blissed out that she doesn't care. Their food starts arriving from the kitchen, all dishes meant to share. A velvety lobster bisque, a lightly dressed salad of microgreens and brightly colored discs that turn out to be crisp sweet radish, pan-seared lobster with a grapefruit beurre blanc served over savory soft polenta. Sirloin au poivre that comes with Dauphine potatoes. Walnut-sized croquettes filled with buttery heaven. Franklin stops between bites and kisses Tabitha lightly on the lips, which incites desire more than a deep kiss might. They don't take any photos. They don't check in or post. This date is like something from another age. Tabitha tries to memorize every detail so she can relive it later. Dessert is an assortment of treats served on a wooden Lazy Susan, a passion fruit panna cotta, miniature cannoli filled with pistachio cream, lemon blueberry tarts with an almond ginger crust, toffee blondies topped with coconut fluff. Tabitha takes a bite of each, then groans because she is so full. She excuses herself for the ladies' room. When she emerges, Annalisa is standing in the vestibule, seemingly waiting for her.
I hope you didn't mind my wisecrack about Nantucket, she says. I was just having fun with you.
Tabitha, loosened by the wine, laughs.
Not a worry. I think it's great that Franklin wanted to bring you out here for dinner. He sounded so excited when he called to make the reservation. And he was very clear that he was bringing Tabitha Frost, not Harper Frost. Because I think we can all agree, if he took your sister out here for dinner, that would be really weird.
Weird, Tabitha repeats. Weird because...
Annalisa swats Tabitha's arm.
because of everything that just happened. But I'm glad you aren't letting that stand in your way. You two are a regular couple of lovebirds. On the way home, Tabitha realizes that she didn't tell Franklin about Julian. She skipped right over him, as if he didn't exist. But if she wants Franklin to know her, then she has to remedy that. She's just not sure how to bring it up. When Ainsley was 18 months old, I got pregnant again. But things didn't go as planned. I went into labor at 28 weeks. Tabitha leans her head back against the car seat and closes her eyes. She'll tell Franklin about Julian another time, she decides. She doesn't want to ruin the magic of their time together. There's something I need to talk to you about, Franklin says. He reaches across the console and touches her thigh. Tabitha? Tabitha opens her eyes. His voice sounds serious, but only seconds ago she decided she didn't want to talk about anything heavy, deep, or real. She thinks back to the peculiar interaction with Annalisa. Weird, because of everything that just happened. Annalisa must have been referring to Harper's affair with Dr. Zimmer. It would indeed be weird if Harper then went on a romantic date with someone else. Maybe we should save talking for tomorrow, Tabitha says. I've had a lot of wine. This concerns tomorrow, Franklin says. I just decided that I'm going to help you with Billy's house.
You are? Tabitha says.
I am, Franklin says. We can talk about a plan of attack in the morning.
Are you sure? Tabitha says. You seemed hesitant before. You said there were extenuating circumstances.
There were. There are. But I've been mulling it over, and I cannot. Here he squeezes her leg. And I mean, I cannot let anyone else on this island work that closely with you. It has to be me. I'm your guy.
She nods, thinking, I'm completely in love with this person.
Intellectually, she knows this isn't possible. You do not fall in love with someone you've known for, well, basically, a matter of hours. It's called something else. Infatuation, which evaporates like dew in the sunshine. But it feels just like love.